Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. I'm Sarah Gonzalez. I used to work at WNYC. I'm now a reporter at NPR's Planet Money podcast, and I'm so happy to be back here filling in for Brian today and talking to some of my very favorite listeners in all of public radio. Today on the show, our right to a fair and speedy trial is enshrined in the Sixth Amendment, but a new investigation has found that prosecutors in the Bronx are slowing this process down on purpose, stretching out court cases well over a year. Why? Then, an assassination attempt on Venezuela's extremely unpopular socialist president by drone captured on live TV. Every day, Venezuela's currency is plummeting. Their money is losing so much value that you need millions in cash to pay for the smallest things, like a cup of coffee. It's gotten so inconvenient to carry money and pay for anything in cash that the government has decided to completely get rid of their currency and print a whole new one. Also, later in the show, we speak with the former education secretary under President Obama, Arnie Duncan. He says our whole education system runs on lies. But first, of course, we try to stay caught up on everything going on in Washington. President Trump reinstated sanctions against Iran overnight. Some of them went into effect at midnight. Five states go to the polls today. There are four primary elections and a special election in Ohio that the GOP is watching closely. And, of course, the tax and bank fraud trial of former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort continues today. Yesterday's trial ended with some pretty remarkable testimony from special counsel Robert Mueller's star witness, a guy named Rick Gates. He is Paul Manafort's longtime business partner, a former Trump campaign deputy, and the deputy chairman of Trump's inaugural committee. Gates and Manafort were charged together, but Rick Gates entered a plea deal. He agreed to testify against his former boss and to help the government with its case against Manafort in exchange for leniency in his own case. And joining us now to help us keep up with this trial and the constant drama in Washington is the Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today, Susan Page. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
Hey, Sarah. It's great to be with you.
Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'm glad to hear that.
So first, Susan, can you just describe what yesterday's testimony was like? I mean, Rick was sitting right there in front of his former boss and friend, it seems like, telling the jury that they committed crimes together, that they laundered money together. Tell us what the testimony was like.
It was pretty remarkable. Rick Gates, whose entire adult career has been linked with Paul Manafort, came into the courtroom, refused to look Manafort in the eye. Manafort was glaring at him through much of the testimony, and said that yes, he'd committed a variety of crimes. He committed crimes on behalf of Paul Manafort, financial crimes, and he said he committed financial crimes against Paul Manafort, that he stole hundreds of thousands of dollars from him. And this involves cases involving evading taxes and defrauding banks. He's back on the stand this morning. It's really been, it's building a remarkable case against a person who has been one of the big figures in Republican politics over decades.
And tell us more about Rick Gates and Paul Manafort's relationship. I mean, they worked side by side for years, and they seem to be friends. Like, Rick Gates seemed to know some pretty specific details about, like, how much Paul Manafort pays for season tickets to sports teams, right?
You know, they did not come in this testimony. They came across less as friends than I think we had expected from just looking, from just reading about them. He started, Rick Gates started as Paul Manafort's intern, and he portrayed himself as being more of an employee than a colleague, than a peer. So that was, I thought, just a little bit of a surprise in the testimony we heard. But they have clearly been very closely associated with one another, both in their financial dealings and also in their dealings with the Trump campaign.
And Gates is sort of the guy that everyone has been waiting to hear from. Like, we've been waiting for this testimony. He is the government's star witness. Just remind us more what we learned. We learned that Gates and Manafort had secret overseas bank accounts, that they were collecting millions in political consulting payments, and that they were deliberately keeping them from the United States so they wouldn't have to pay taxes on that income, right?
That's right. They were lying to banks to get loans, and they were evading taxes by having overseas accounts. And some of this we knew before from the paper trail that the prosecutors had laid out before Rick Gates took the stand. But, you know, there's nothing like having somebody sit there and say, yes, I broke the law. Yes, we did this. Yes, I was acting on at the behest of Paul Manafort. That is pretty compelling testimony, and it exhibited the kind of meticulous case that Robert Mueller has built up in what is his first criminal trial since the special counsel was named.
And as you mentioned, Rick Gates did admit to stealing or embezzling money from Manafort, from his business partner. He has already pled guilty to lying to federal prosecutors. Does all of this compromise Gates as a trustworthy witness?
Well, you know, one thing that prosecutors tell us is that the witnesses in criminal trials like this tend to be people who are criminals themselves. So you saw the prosecution doing a very careful job of trying to lay out all the dark underside of Rick Gates from the start, with him talking about how he himself broke the law and to acknowledging that the reason he is testifying is in hopes of getting less jail time himself or even just probation when he is sentenced, that he has struck this plea deal because he says he is guilty. Now, it's up to the jury to decide whether they're going to believe him or not, but you saw the prosecution trying to preemptively put all this out there so there'll be nothing left for the defense to raising questions about Rick Gates's credibility.
And the defense is up next this morning. The government, the special prosecutor, still has a couple hours of questions left for Rick Gates, but then Paul Manafort's attorney, the defense attorneys, it's their turn to cross-examine Rick Gates. What do you think will happen during that cross-examination?
Well, you know, I don't know if you've been on a jury. I've been on a jury in D.C.
I have not, and I've been trying desperately to get selected for a jury.
Well, one of the things I found on the juries I was on was the prosecution would have its case, and I would be thinking in my head, that guy is definitely guilty. And then the defense sometimes raised issues that you thought, oh, well, this is a different way of looking at this. That is the role of the defense, and perhaps they'll be successful doing it. But it does, independent legal experts say this does seem like a pretty small, strong case. And while nothing in this case really involves President Trump, it is seen as kind of a test run for whether the special counsel can deliver a big conviction against a major figure as they go into issues that do involve President Trump. And, of course, there continues to be the question that if Paul Manafort is convicted, would he be willing to strike a plea deal or strike a sentencing deal to trade time, a favorable treatment for himself in exchange for information about what happened during the Trump campaign.
And listeners, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today. We're talking about the tax and bank fraud trial against Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort. His former employee gave pretty remarkable testimony about Paul in Manafort in court yesterday and is continuing that testimony this morning. Listeners, if you have a question for my guest, Susan Page, about the trial or any of the news coming out of D.C., she's the one to ask. Give us a call, 212-433-WNY. That's 212-433-9692. Okay, Susan, so to recap, yesterday was day five of Paul Manafort's trial. Prosecutors alleged that Manafort had a multi-year tax and bank fraud scheme going on, and Gates said he was the one who helped organize the paperwork for that scheme. What are the stakes here? How much time are these men facing?
Well, Paul Manafort is—I forget exactly—is he 69? He's old enough that he faces the prospect of spending the rest of his life in jail. And we know that Rick Gates is hoping to avoid that kind of long sentence by cooperating with the prosecution. You know, for the prosecution, there's a lot at stake here too. This is—you know—of course, President Trump has repeatedly characterized the special counsel's investigation as a witch hunt. If the special counsel succeeds in getting this big conviction, this would make it harder to argue that the investigation and the enterprise that they're doing is a witch hunt.
And so then what are the main stakes for the president, if any? Like, how high does this go up? Do we know?
I think there are signs that President Trump is feeling increasingly embattled. And one way to judge that, of course, is by the string of tweets that he has posted in recent days that take a very critical tone toward the special counsel. So I think that you could look at that and say that the president is feeling some threat here. His attitude toward Paul Manafort has been interesting. In the past, he's described him as an honorable man who's been caught in difficult circumstances. But I think he would also hope to kind of distance himself from Paul Manafort, and he has said that he didn't work for him very long and he didn't know him very well. So I think you see the president being in something of a bind here.
Is there any talk about the president like potentially pardoning Manafort?
Well, the president, of course, has pardon power that is basically unlimited. It's unchecked. And he has issued pardons before that have not gone through the traditional process with the Justice Department. So in all these cases with Paul Manafort, with Michael Cohen, his former fixer who is now in the crosshairs of investigators, there is always speculation about whether President Trump might pardon them. But I think in fairness, you'd have to say that President Trump has not himself indicated that he's inclined to do that.
Okay. And listeners, if you have a question or comment for Susan, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. I want to move now to the famous Trump Tower meeting, the campaign meeting that took place in 2016 between Russians and Donald Trump Jr. at Trump Tower. First, Donald Trump Jr. said that it was a meeting just to discuss the adoption of Russian children. But now, in a tweet, the president has admitted that that meeting was, in fact, about getting information on his opponent, Hillary Clinton. And now people are trying to figure out whether this is legal or not. Opposition research is one thing, but some say that it's illegal for a campaign to accept help from any foreign individual or foreign government, whether they got information on Hillary or not. Susan, is it legal to take meetings with foreign governments, for campaigns to take meetings with foreign governments?
It is a violation of the federal law to accept anything of value from foreign interests in a campaign. That is clearly a violation of the law. Now, the question becomes...
Meaning monetary value or...
That's not just monetary, but that is a legal question.
Okay.
What is something of value? And one question might be, if you got negative information about Hillary Clinton from the Russians or from Russian interests, would that be something of value? And that is probably a question better put to a lawyer than a journalist, but that is a central question here. And that was one reason the president's tweet this weekend was so remarkable, because he acknowledged that this meeting was held to see if they had negative information about Hillary Clinton that the Trump campaign could use. So that puts them very close. That puts them at risk of violation of federal law. And, of course, this involves not just a campaign manager President Trump hired. It involves his son, Donald Trump Jr., who attended that meeting.
And so the issue is whether Donald Trump Jr. could have committed a crime, and if the president was involved, you know, might he have committed a crime also?
Right. Michael Cohen has said that President Trump knew about the meeting before it took place. President Trump has said he didn't know about the meeting before it took place. But one of the other effects of the tweet that the president put out over the weekend, and isn't it remarkable we have to repeatedly dissect president's tweets, but that's where we are at this point. One of the remarkable things about it is that he acknowledges it took place. He acknowledges it was for the purposes of gathering dirt, and that these acknowledgments are at odds with the previous explanations that the White House and the president had given about this meeting.
Right, and the Trump campaign is obviously under investigation for possible collusion with Russia. The president is under scrutiny for possible obstruction of justice, and he's tweeting all these statements about legally sensitive issues. Does this make him, the president, vulnerable?
You know, I think that if he was following the advice of his lawyer, he would be off Twitter on these issues.
But probably a long time ago.
Yes, probably. But good luck in trying to keep him off Twitter. I actually think the president is not following a legal strategy here. I think President Trump is following a political strategy, and that is to raise questions about the validity of the special counsel's investigation. if he convinces Americans that the special counsel's investigation isn't legitimate, is a witch hunt, then whatever conclusion the special counsel comes to, those Americans will think, I can't trust this. I'm not sure I should take this seriously. I'm going to take this with a grain of salt. And I think that is actually the motivation the president is following. And the question is, does following this political strategy put him in legal peril? And that's something that we're likely to find out over the next months.
And what you mentioned, I mean, it's pretty similar to what he's doing with the media as well, just making people question the media.
Absolutely. I think that he is also trying to undermine trust in the news media by calling it fake news, raising questions about whether reporters just make things up. And as he said a week or so ago, he said, don't believe what you read and hear, what you read and see. Well, that's, of course, the essence of journalism, that we want people to believe what they read and see. This is part of undermining, I think, faith in the institutions that could challenge him.
Okay, I want to go to a listener. Trey in Huntington, New York has a question. Hi, Trey.
Hi, how you doing? I was wondering if Mueller can use a matter of national security to bring Trump to the table, because this is a matter of national security. If the Russians were interfering or if they colluded with a president or his campaign. Thank you.
Meaning, can Mueller get Trump to testify? I believe that's your question.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I think it's a matter of national security, and if he can argue that from that standpoint, so he has to have a sit down with him to find out what actually happened.
Susan, do you know the answer?
Yeah, Trey. Hey, thanks for your question. You know, the president, the special counsel is now trying to negotiate with the president's lawyers to see if he will voluntarily testify. I think that's unlikely. I think that these negotiations have gone on for some time. It seems like they're getting farther away, not closer together. Then, at that point, the special counsel could try to subpoena the president and to force him to testify, and that would likely spark a legal battle over whether a sitting president can be subpoenaed and forced to testify. I think it's entirely possible the president's lawyers would fight that subpoena. I don't think arguing that this is a national security case probably applies here. I think it's more a legal matter of can a president be forced to comply with a subpoena? And that may be something we find out pretty soon.
Okay, and next, Chris in Manhattan has a question about the Trump Tower meeting we were just talking about. Hi, Chris.
Oh, hi. How you doing? Thank you very much for taking my call. After listening to your description about how Trump might approach, you know, the political side of the Trump Tower meeting, it came to my mind that is it also possible that he's trying to devalue the information in the public's eye so that if it became an issue of was there a value to the meeting, he's basically saying, no, everything we learned about Hillary we knew was false and it had no value and it had no impact on the election.
Chris, that's just a great point because it's sort of like one of the things that we've seen the president do, which is by talking out loud about some things that it means that it was not collusion because he's doing it in public. When he talks in public, for instance, at a famous time during the campaign when he stood up in front of cameras and invited the Russians to try to hack Hillary Clinton's emails, that could not be in a case of collusion because he did it in public. I think a similar thing could apply here, that just by doing it in public, it undermines it as a legal peril for him. So we'll see.
All right. And then we'll go to one other caller, LaTanya in Rockland, New York. Hi, LaTanya.
Hi, good morning. My question was, and as always, when you listen to talk radio, you'll hear more comments and your question will change somehow. My question was about Mueller. It's great that we're getting all of this information regarding the president, but at some point, does he just go ahead and present what he has? So what, if it's going to be an indictment, if it's going to be a delayed indictment? Like, I think the public is getting inundated with a lot of information. And it's not so much that he will change our position politically. I think he's just wearing us down is what he's really doing.
The special counsel, Robert Mueller, or the president?
No, the president. Okay. With all of the information that every time something comes out, I'm a criminal defense attorney. I've never seen this much information come out in an investigation ever. at some point, will he just present his case and get it over with?
Well, Latanya, as a criminal defense attorney, we should probably be asking you questions instead of me. But, yes, this is a subject of considerable speculation in Washington. And the special counsel has been very closed mouth. This has not been an operation that has leaked a lot. The things that have leaked about his investigation have come mostly from attorneys for defendants, not from the special counsel's office itself. I think the assumption is that Robert Mueller at some point will make a report about what he's found. There's a lot of speculation about the timing of that report. There's some thought that he would want to do it before Labor Day to avoid getting in the way of the midterm elections, and that if he can't do it by then, he'll wait until after the midterm elections. But we don't actually know if that's the truth, because whenever you read about what Robert Mueller is thinking, believe me, that is not Robert Mueller talking. That is people three steps away from Robert Mueller speculating about what he's going to do.
All right. Thanks, Susan. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Sarah Gonzalez sitting in for Brian Lehrer, and we're speaking with Susan Page about all of the latest political news. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. I want to move on now to Iran sanctions. President Trump reinstated sanctions against Iran overnight. Some of them went into effect at midnight. Susan, what do these sanctions mean, or do you know what it looks like on the ground in Iran right now?
Well, we know there have been protests in Iran and a lot of concern about the economic impact that these sanctions are going to have. These are sanctions that have been lifted in 2015 after that nuclear accord was reached with President Obama. And the sanctions had really hurt in Iran. So there was a lot of optimism in Iran that in exchange for agreeing to limits and inspections on their nuclear program, that their economy could do better. Now that's really threatened. You know, many of our allies in Europe and elsewhere are not imposing sanctions on Iran, but the fact that the United States has means that if a European country does business with Iran, the United States will not allow it to do business in the United States. And, of course, the U.S. is a much bigger market than Iran is, which puts these companies in a bind and is going to, we think, have a big effect in Iran economically. The question is, will reimposing the sanctions have a big effect on Iran politically? Will Iran then behave in the ways that the Trump administration says it must in order to get the sanctions lifted? And the Trump administration, Secretary of State Pompeo, has laid out a really high bar for Iran to get out of these sanctions. They'd have to curtail their nuclear program. They'd have to stop funding terrorist organizations. They would need to withdraw their troops from Syria. So it seems unlikely that Iran is going to be willing to do all those things in response to these sanctions. But definitely a big reaction on the ground in Iran today.
And just to remind our listeners, the international deal sought to limit Iran's nuclear program. Iran agreed to not build a nuclear program until at least 2030. The president said that was not long enough, so he pulled out of the deal and restored the sanctions. There are some special elections today in a couple states, five states. There are four primaries, primary elections in Kansas, Michigan, Missouri, and Washington. Susan, you're from Kansas, right? Tell us about the race there.
I am. I was born and raised in Kansas, and the politics in Kansas have been pretty fierce. We have the primaries for the denomination in both parties for governor of Kansas, and that's become a real test of President Trump. Trump just yesterday endorsed Kris Kobach, who has been the very active on issues of immigration and on voter fraud. He's the Secretary of State in Kansas. And he's running against the current governor, Jeff Collier, who had succeeded to the governorship when Sam Brownback took a job in the State Department and resigned as government. Collier had been lieutenant governor. The two men had been very close in what polling we've seen in Kansas. The two were very close, and this means that it's possible, entirely possible, that Trump's endorsement will bring Kris Kobach over the finish line tonight in the Kansas primary. President Trump has an almost unbroken record in contested Republican primaries of having his candidate win, sometimes even when his candidate has been a long shot. So we're watching closely for that. This has been encouraging to Democrats in Kansas on the theory that Kris Kobach is an extreme figure, somebody with such very conservative views on these issues, that it might open the door to a Democrat winning the governorship, although that is an uphill battle in a state like Kansas, which is overwhelmingly Republican.
And Kris Kobach is a Republican running against a sitting Republican governor. He ran the Voting Integrity Commission, which was, I guess, the commission that was claiming that people were voting illegally, which turned out to be disproven. And there's a special election for a congressional seat in Ohio. It's been vacant since January when the Republican congressman resigned. And it seems like Republicans are especially concerned about losing that seat. It's been held by Republicans for decades. This is a district that went to Trump in the election. This is an August special election. It's not the kind of thing that usually like brings in the big GOP leaders, but House Speaker Paul Ryan, Vice President Mike Pence, and even the president have been showing up in Ohio's 12th congressional district. Here's a clip of Vice President Pence.
The other side talks about this blue wave thing that's supposed to be coming. Here in Ohio, 12, history will record that the red wave started here.
Well, I guess we'll see tonight if a red wave is starting there. I mean, this is a congressional district that went for President Trump by 11 percentage points in 2016, by double digits. And the fact that Republicans have had to pump millions of dollars into this race, send in the president, send in the vice president, is a sign of just how much trouble Republicans believe they're in. In these congressional races coming up, Democrats have outperformed their 26 levels by about 12 percentage points so far in the special elections we've seen this year. That would be enough to have a Democrat elected in this special election tonight. But just the fact that it's competitive is seen as a big red flag for Republicans, because if Ohio 12th district is competitive, there are about 80 congressional districts that Republicans now hold that are going to be competitive in November.
If a Democrat were to win, what would this tell us about the Democratic Party Democratic voters? Does it tell us a whole lot, or is it just mainly that like Democrats are more motivated to show up for midterm elections? I mean, what would it mean for Democrats if they lost
this seat? We would need to look and see what actually happened in the vote. And it's always wise not to make too many predictions as people are actually going to the polls, because so often we turn out to be wrong. But if the Democratic candidate wins in this race, I think it would mean that Democratic voters were energized to get out, and that some Republican-leaning voters, especially in Ohio suburbs, in Columbus suburbs, switched their support. Traditionally, Republican voters voted for the Democrat this time. I think it seems to me that is probably the combination of things that would allow the Democrat to win. Danny O'Connor's the name of the Democrat, that would allow him to win. He's also been, you know, what special elections don't always tell us a lot about the general election that follows, because special elections are special and they get a lot of attention that not all the races will get in the November midterms. Danny O'Connor has been a pretty good candidate in this race, and Troy Balderson, who is the Republican, has been, Republicans say, a pretty weak candidate. Although this is what happens when you get to voting day. If a party thinks their candidate's about to lose, sometimes they blame him or her for running a bad race to make it less of an indication of some larger trend if and when they lose.
And before I let you go, Susan, I want to switch gears just a little bit. You're writing a biography on Barbara Bush. I think you have a manuscript due like tomorrow, right?
Tomorrow, okay. Yes.
Well, thanks for coming on our show when you're on deadline. I understand the feeling. Okay, well, you tweeted out recently that First Ladies Melania Trump and Barbara Bush actually had something pretty interesting in common. You wrote that you were unable to think about another example in American history where there was a quasi-public split between a president and his spouse. What were you referring to?
Well, Melania Trump's communications director tweeted out the First Lady's basic support for LeBron James. this after the president had really criticized him in a big way. And you know, there are times when first ladies disagree with their husband. Barbara Bush, for instance, disagreed with her husband on abortion rights. She supported abortion rights. He did not. But she kept her mouth shut when she was first lady. She never publicly challenged him on that issue. She didn't really acknowledge her support for abortion rights until they were out of before they were in the White House and after they were out, but not while he was in office. And so this is, I think, unusual to see this kind of divide between a first lady and a president. Maybe Eleanor Roosevelt sometimes challenged Franklin Roosevelt, but you're going back pretty far to find an example of this happening before.
And I'm not necessarily opposed to wives challenging their husbands. No. But I mean, the fact that they do it publicly, I mean, what is it? Does it tell us anything?
Well, it may tell us something about the state of the marriage of the president and the first lady. This has been the subject of, as you know, enormous speculation, starting with the speculation about whether Melania Trump was going to move to Washington to live in the White House. So there's a lot of curiosity about it. I'm not sure there's like a larger point, and I certainly agree with you that spouses have the right to disagree with one another. It's just politically unusual, that's all.
Interesting. Okay, I think we're going to end it there. We've been speaking with Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today. Susan, thank you so much for joining us and filling us in on everything.
Thank you, Sarah.